Lord, we're thinking this morning of necessary compliance, and we're doing that, looking at 1 Timothy and chapter 2, and from verse 8 to the end of the chapter. Paul's instruction to Timothy for the ordering of the church in its worship, its evangelistic endeavors, its prayers, and so forth. And so this morning from verse 8 in 1 Timothy 2, Paul begins with regards to praying. How are we to pray? And I want you to look at verse 8, just under three headings, a little bit of alliteration, hopefully will help you memorize. But in the text, there's a reference to the place for prayer, posture in prayer, and a predisposition with regards to praying. So first of all, verse 8, Paul says, I will therefore that men pray everywhere. Now, he means everywhere where there is ordered worship, where there is a gathering of God's people to seek their God. The context is primarily worship in the church. He's referred earlier, indeed, in verse 7, to the fact he's a teacher of the Gentiles in faith and truth. We're thinking of the public gatherings and the worship of God's people primarily, but what he says here with regards to prayer would also apply in the general context and sense. And he speaks of the place. I will therefore that men pray everywhere. There is no unique place for praying. There's no such place that is supremely sacred, a sacred location that adds something to the prayers of God's people. Must be a wonderful thing, I suppose, to visit what so many know as the Holy Land and go to various sites and excited by praying in the various locations and to think of the teaching, a miracle that happened there that the Lord performed. Indeed, if they're on the actual sites at all, but this is what's said, and some are particularly excited and moved by the fact that they are there and they pray. But there is nothing. Paul says, I will wherever there is a gathering of God's people that they pray. It's how they pray, the disposition as they pray. But there's no sacred location that adds to prayer. No country, no city, not Israel, not in the chapel, not in the cathedral. I'm sure you've spoken to people and they've told you how it was amazing. It was a lovely thing just to retreat. Now, in so much as it's away from the hustle and bustle, you can imagine if you're a patient in hospital and the hospital's got a little chapel somewhere, a patient getting up from that ward that's just noise constant and going down. But that's only into a quiet place. If you could have found a little boot room or where the brushes, a little utility cupboard, and it was quiet, it would have just been as effective to lift your heart to God as from the chapel, the cathedral. Oh, there was a presence often people will think of, a special place facing east, facing west, north, south. Does it matter? No, there's no sacred place. There's no special direction. Oh, indeed, the Jews did look eastward and towards the temple. And of course, as you know, Muslims pray toward Mecca. But there's no special place. There's nothing special in doing such a thing at all. No, says Paul, I will therefore that men pray everywhere. The place, wherever they're gathered, that prayer is an essential part of the worship of God. It has to be there, and it has to be real praying, reverent, humility. For that comes next. Notice, lifting up holy hands. Well, there's no one posture again in the scriptures that's advocated as above another. Indeed, there are many postures that are referred to. They knelt, they raised their hands, they smote their breast, they bowed their head to the ground, they would not so much, or the one in the temple, you remember, would not so much as lift his eyes to heaven. Then there were those who lifted up their eyes to heaven. Solomon kneeled before the altar and raised his hands to heaven. There's no one posture, though, that is stated to be above another and a requirement for prayer. No, indeed, what Paul refers to here, and it probably was a common practice of standing and lifting the hands heavenward as an acknowledgement of need, of emptiness, of appeal. It's all about now, not so much the posture as the attitude coming before God to pray. And you notice what he says. This prayer must be the lifting up of holy hands. Holy hands. Put the emphasis on the holy. For the holy hand really is a depiction or a representation of the life that's lived. What kind of praying comes from unholy hands, an unholy life? Somebody living the life of a hypocrite. Somebody cheating. Somebody being unfaithful. Somebody not giving. Somebody covetous. Somebody with no heart for the things of God. That's not lifting up holy hands. No, the term could mean unpolluted hands. A life free in as much as it's possible from sins and corruption and double dealing. No, that's what Paul means here. The place is unimportant. Wherever you are, wherever God's people meet, let the men pray. Pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands. Let it be from a life that's relatively free, for we'll never be perfectly free, but free from sin, free from wicked deeds, duplicity, and so on, or any unfaithfulness. So the place and the posture, the predisposition comes also without wrath and doubting. Now, what has Paul in mind? I suspect because at the beginning of the chapter, he has exhorted Timothy and says, I exhort, therefore Timothy was to do this in his exhortation of others. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings. Well, many of them would have been hostile to the church and would have abused Christians or given instruction to abuse Christians. So it would be terribly easy in our prayers for all men to think of some and to pray accordingly. Oh, Lord, beat this man into the dust. Lord, deal with this persecutor of your people. Or indeed, perhaps it just comes right down to more mundane. The cold face, being angry with a brother, having a grudge. Would God receive such prayers from such a heart if we were angry? The term means a settled indignation, indignant about something. William Hendrickson says it would be the prayer of the unmerciful or the treatment of the unmerciful debtor in the parable. We are not to have an attitude like his. Demanding, cruel, cold. Do we feel like that against people or someone in particular if you come to pray? Will the Lord receive that prayer from a heart that's angry and indignant and despises someone or rejects them or looks down upon them and so forth? No, says Paul, that's not the kind of praying. Pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands, committed life to God, and without wrath and doubting. Now, indeed, that term doubting has a derivative in English that we translate as dialogue. So what Paul means here is someone now who, when he comes to pray, is indignant, is an angry person for some particular reason, whatever the reason might be, and engages in a dialogue, but with himself. He's reasoning. He's thinking. Is this just? Is this right? Maybe ill will, reasoning, weighing up something. Maybe even planning, plotting something ill against another, or planning to get even, and that going alongside with the term wrath is wholly forbidden. That cannot be a prayer that would be received. So we have to not despise. We have to be free of ill will and grudge bearing. Pray for all men, he has said, kings. Don't let, yes, your sense of injustice as they mistreat the people of God, but it mustn't fester to the point where you're angry and indignant and reason with yourself. Is this just? Certainly no reasoning that would question God's dealings, for he's infinitely wise and just and good. Just leave the people with him. He will see and deal with the unjust in his own time. So I will therefore, says Paul, that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands, without wrath and doubting. Now then, in like manner also, that women adorn themselves. Has he moved completely onto another subject? Is the phrase "in like manner" also referring to verse 8 and the praying in the public meetings of the church? Can women pray? Ought women to pray? Well, if you're John Calvin, you say that's exactly what Paul is saying. When he says "in like manner also," he's saying just as men everywhere are to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting, so women also. Many disagree with him, because Paul will make it plain in the public gathering of the church, the worship service, most certainly, women are not to pray. Women are to be silent in the church. So we come to that perhaps in a moment. So if it's not then verse 9, "in like manner also," which could be translated similarly, what is he referring to when he goes on to say that women adorn themselves in modest apparel? Well, I think the consensus by most that hold to this doctrine of silence of women in the church, in the public services, they do not lead in prayer, they do not pray, they do not read, they are not to be pastors, deacons, or deaconesses, or whatever else. Well, for the many that hold that, the hermeneutic, the interpretation is this. In like manner also to the men who must come, and as they come, they must prepare themselves to pray. That will be their role if leaders within the church. They will come, they will be leading in prayer. Let men everywhere pray. If it's the public worship service that's in mind, and again in a general context and application, this would apply to praying at any time, anywhere. Praying everywhere, lifting up holy hands and without wrath and doubting. That's the emphasis for them. That's what they are to do. What is he saying then when he says similarly that women adorn themselves in modest apparel? This is how we know this is the public worship meeting. You're not going to get dressed up in your own home to do anything, are you? To pray. You don't put special clothes on. No, what Paul means is this. And just as the men must prepare themselves, as it were, to come and pray in this holy manner, so the women who are coming out to worship God in the public worship meeting, they too have a particular responsibility. And he has an emphasis here. And it may have been something that he had seen, observed, and was an issue as he writes to Timothy. Having said what he would have the men do, come prepared, godly lives, no duplicity, no hypocrisy, not up to anything, secretive, hidden, lifting up holy hands, and without wrath and doubting, in like manner also, let them be godly women. Let them come so they can engage in, they can say the amens inaudibly. They can agree with the prayer as they're led. They can sing in the praise. They can worship. They can lift up their hearts to God. They can hear the word. They too are together. But look, there is a specific way. There is something to avoid. So similarly, holy, godly women, that they adorn themselves in modest apparel. Simple. Not dowdy. Not the extreme opposite. Not dressed in, sackcloth. No, you can be fashionable. Modern. As long as it meets the criterion of modesty. Without costing too much. This would apply also. Now notice what he says here. Also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness, humility, and a sobriety, thoughtfulness, a gravitas, sincerity, not with broided or plaited hair or gold or pearls or costly array. Now it seems these were the in things in Paul's day. Plaited hair was very popular. You know, hairstyles, they vary. They change, don't they? Well, plaited hair was the big thing. If the ladies in Paul's day had been in the hairdressers, and there were the copies of the women's magazines, they would have said, perhaps, as they come to have their hair done, I want it like hers. Here's the model of the day. Look at the plaits in her. Can you do mine like hers? So this was the big thing. It said of Caligula's wife, though he was an emperor, of course, that she dressed, and her style and the plaiting of her hair. And when it says plaits with hair here, you have to think of the jewelry that went with it. Jeweled tortoise shell combs, pins of ivory or silver or bronze with jeweled heads. Pin heads that were carved with images of animals or a figure or an idol. They were items of luxury. Caligula's wife was said to have dressed, and just her dress and her jewelry, something the equivalent, and this is an American now, of $1 million. This is Dr. Hendrickson. How they estimated it, I don't know, but there she was with her jewels and gems, and apparently the very head, her head would sparkle, bedecked with so many jewels and gems to hold her hair in place or whatever. They sourced their pearls, he refers to gold, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, wherever the pearls around their neck or in their robes or whatever, pearls sourced from the Indian Ocean or the Persian Gulf and extremely costly. Now, says Paul, women aren't to draw attention to themselves like that. That's not their chief consideration. That shouldn't be the thing. Oh, the best dressed woman in the church. What's it matter? No, says Paul. In like manner, similarly, holy, godly, seeking to live in simplicity and please the Lord, grateful to him, seeking to influence others, as we'll see, primarily within the home, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness, humility, sobriety, a soberness, a sincerity, a gravitas, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array. Forget these things. They're unimportant to God. Indeed, they're ugly in his sight. The more costly, the more ugly to God. Now, what's of great value? Well, verse 10, but which becometh or is fitting for women professing godliness with good works. How's your Christian life and service? Could you say you're adorned with good works? A godliness, a faithfulness, seeking to glorify Christ and to contribute and to help, engaged in the cause of the Lord. This is what's special to God. This is what you want to tell the women, Timothy, says Paul. Apply these things. Tell them not to be influenced by the world. The fleshly, the carnal, they worry about these things. They are absorbed with them. Look at the magazines. Look at the millions and billions in various industries for cosmetics and all kinds of things. Fashion and trend. And no sooner is one in till it's out and something else is in. And, oh, it's so big. And young women aspiring to the catwalk and so on, to model the latest fashions and so forth. That's a carnality. That's to be absorbed with things, material things, and this world and its values. And it really is atrocious in God's sight. He would look on that woman who is regarded as totally insignificant. And nobody, but godly. And he looks at the soul that's robed in the righteousness of Christ, and he sees the good works of that godly woman. That's what's pleasing to him. Don't be drawn or sucked into the world and such like things overmuch. Don't go the other extreme, as we say, and dress as in like sackcloth or something. You don't have to do that either. No major on the good works. Look, verse 11. And again, let the woman learn in silence with all subjection or submission. She has a specific role. And you know, headship isn't one of them. No, indeed, women have an innate tendency to submit It's a natural tendency. But of course, because of the fall, then that now is turned on its head. It's quite easy for us to see it in the day and age we are living in, because the feminist movement, let's not be overly critical with regards to some things, women's rights, needed to be looked at. But common sense, a Bible, a sense of justice, fairness, the knowledge of God himself would have said they were being abused and that can't possibly be right. And of course it should never have happened. But it's gone right over. And the feminist movement and the humanist now is claiming a position and a place and a role that's been denied women. Here's how William Hendrickson puts it. He says, when Paul says, let a woman learn in silence and with all subjection, and verse 12, I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. He says, how gracious, how kind of God. William Hendrickson says, yes, for it would be like putting a bird under water. It's out of its environment. It's in an environment that it can't survive. It's like taking the fish out of the water onto dry land. It won't survive. He said to place women in places of leadership and roles within the church, and taking the place of the male in headship roles, he said that would be abusive. That is wrong. No, this is gracious. For you see, there are not only physiological differences and specific roles and places and functions. Physiological differences, male and female. There are also psychological differences, mindset. It is the woman's natural mindset to be supportive. After all, that's how God made the woman. That's why he made the woman. It was this support role, to be supportive of male headship. Now, if God has created us that way, sin trying to distort and turn things on its head, well, you can see where the feminist movement is coming from and what motivates them. No male headship. And yes, it is a gracious thing for God to remind the women, headship was not for them. They'll be out of their environment. There'll be problems. There'll be difficulties. Psychologically, they're not made. They haven't that addition, if you like, that mindset and something within it that equips man naturally for headship and the woman to support. And then Paul argues this from the creation order itself. Verse 13, for Adam was first formed, then Eve. Now, if God had meant total equality in absolutely everything, there were certain things open to him. Well, in fact, if he meant woman headship, he would have made Eve first. That's according to Paul's logic. For he said he made Adam first, and he's making a point of this. God did that deliberately. It wasn't an arbitrary selection. Oh, I'm going to make man, woman. Oh, okay. Toss the coin. I'll make the man first. That's flippant. No, he made the man very specifically and deliberately, and he's going to bless him and place upon him this great responsibility, men, and I'll apply it in a minute, because it is a great responsibility. I hope you're ahead in the right sense. I hope you're leading your home in the right sense, for you're responsible. Don't think that just comes from, I'm head. I get the remote control. I say where we're going on holiday. I'm the head. No, it's a more awesome thing than that. It's a responsibility as well as a privilege. But notice, Adam was first formed. So God didn't make Eve first, he made Adam. Secondly, says Paul, Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Let me finish my first point. He didn't make Eve first, nor did he make them simultaneously. Because he could have made both at the same time. Total equality. No, he makes Adam. And then we go through all that. The animals being brought. What's that all about? Then the woman. The only fitting helpmate, supporter, would be another human being, but female. God's amazing order. And from that wonderful institution, so much derided and mocked today, the family. Adam was first formed, then Eve. Then verse 14, you see out of, in a way, you could say, here was Eve conned and duped. Satan knows what he's doing. He gets Eve alone. The male headship, maybe the more suspicious, the more alert, the more aware. Maybe there's something in the female psyche that isn't in so much a flaw, because God made man perfect and upright. But it's something that can be tempted or tested from without by a malevolent, malignant being. And that's, of course, Satan, because he's fallen now. And he comes and he plays on this gentility, that aspect of femalehood, psychologically different from the male, not fitted for headship. And he treats her almost as if she is the head. And he tempts, and of course she gives in. And Paul gives this as a reason for, again, not suffering a woman to teach or to have the headship role. Verse 14, Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Then notice, and I come to close with this, notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing. What does saved mean here? Is it physical? Is there a promise here that every woman who bears a child will be safe? Is it referring to physical protection and safety at all? Or is it spiritual? Is he talking about salvation in its fullest sense? Well, yes, he is. He's saying, notwithstanding, she shall be saved. 31 times in Paul's epistles, if we count Hebrews as one of his epistles, and on this occasion, he uses the word saved, the Greek word, that means salvation. He only ever means it in his epistles and the writings of Paul, not of physical salvation at all, but full-blown spiritual salvation. So have you to have children to be saved? What's he saying then? Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing. Well, first of all, the she is still referring to Eve. Then it opens up to the they, meaning all co-gender women believers. This passage here, this text, is simply saying salvation isn't just an experience, then living as one pleases, disregarding, quibbling with, rejecting God's order and God's will for the roles of male and female. No, the evidence that a woman is truly converted is that she accepts her God-given place, God-given role, as indeed does the men. And if motherhood is one of them, then, says Paul, she'll be saved in the childbearing. That is of Eve and the childbearing of Christ. She bore. The evidence of her salvation is in the outworking of her life. There's not a scholar who doesn't really take this line, that this is about salvation and the evidence of it. It's being viewed from the human perspective. She shall be saved in the childbearing through Christ, through the seed that was born, that was promised, that was prophesied. And every woman has her place and her role, and if she gladly and willingly accepts it, if she doesn't quibble, she doesn't fight it, she's in agreement with it, and continues, look, in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety, she'll be evidencing that salvation. She'll demonstrate and show that she is accepting of God's order for men and for women. She won't be quibbling with God. Now, that's what's happened in churches. That's what's happening through the feminist movement and the humanists. They're rewriting the role of men, the role of women, and there's total equality, and it's fighting, and it's quibbling, and it's arguing, and rejecting God's order. And Paul says that's wrong. That should never happen. Notwithstanding, she'll be saved through the child that was born, that Eve was not the one who carried, but through her seed, as God promised, the seed that would come, the seed of the woman. And she would be in that, the first in that huge and long line and lineage right down to the time of the Saviour's birth. So it's about complying with God's order, and here's the evidence of it. Work out your own salvation, ladies, in fear and trembling. It's God that works in you both to will and to do. Here's your role. You gladly accept it. If motherhood, then train up the children in the ways of the Lord. But accept God's order. And men, if headship is your role, as it is, what kind of head are you then? You have a tremendous responsibility. Again, it isn't about choosing a holiday destination or a remote control or what you'll buy in a supermarket if you're there, or spend the amount you'll spend and so forth. It's about leading your home in godliness and in righteousness. Do you do that? Is that left to the woman? Does the woman tell you what to do? No, there's an order, and Paul makes it clear. It's inviolable, it's inflexible, it's perpetual. Whatever our world tells you, ladies, you'll be a God-honoring woman if you accept that role and place, and it's unique and it's special. And he made you physiologically to bear children, but in the providence of God, and then we're in a fallen world, that's withheld from many women. But the role is the supportive role and the recognition of male headship. No, there isn't a place for women leading in the church, praying in the public worship service. We'll just leave it at that. At the very least, Paul is saying that doesn't happen. Silent, in the church, when the church is gathered. But that doesn't mean that you're not equal with regards to grace and salvation and the service of God. You have a unique role, a very special role if you're a mother in the training up of those children, a God-given responsibility and privilege to educate, to teach them, to pray for them, to support the head of the home in so much as he leads spiritually. Well, this is what Paul is saying here. So honour God's order, complying, and salvation through compliance.